Welcome to another Tactical Civics Liberty Cast, empowering Americans to enforce the Constitution and restore liberty.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Tactical Civics National Conference Call for July 14th of 2019.
Thank you, Johnny B. Yeah, I'm David Zuniga of Texas, founder of America Again Trust and of Tactical Civics. Please begin. We begin with a prayer, so join with me in agreement, if you would, a prayer to open our teaching time tonight. Our Father, Creator of the universe, you're amazing. I mean, you actually amaze us on a regular basis, Lord. I'm constantly astounded at your created order, at the mountains and rivers and glaciers of the earth, at your astounding profusion of stuff, birds and mammals, reptiles, amphibians, insects, fish, the invertebrates. Sometimes you get the feeling that, I don't know, you just went wild with every color and with every shape that you could imagine. As we look at the structures, the bodies, the processes that you've made and are making right now in the heavens, the nebulaic super clouds, the newborn stars, the young stars, the older and dying stars, the supernovas, the black holes, and the phenomena that astronomers haven't even named yet. Gorgeous stuff, frightening stuff, overwhelming stuff, beautiful to the point, Father, of bringing tears to our eyes. We can't believe how you do this stuff. We certainly don't know how you do it. And you do it also effortlessly. You do it with your thought. You do it with just your thought. It's overwhelming when we take time to think about this, which we don't very often, but when we do, none of us can begin to make or maintain or even explain things like these amazing things that you've made. We can only wonder at them. We can give them names. We can try to explain how they work, but we can't figure out how you make them, how you sustain them. We can give you thanks. We can praise you. We can glorify you for it, though. And what a universe we live in. What a planet. What a world we live on. And, of course, what a civilization, what a republic you gave us, we Americans, through our fathers, through no merit, through nothing that we did, no merit of our own. But we're supposed to tend it. We're supposed to defend it. It's our duty to maintain it. No other human population has ever had the kind of power, the kind of authority over their own liberty, over their own justice, over their own potential. We have that. But only if we glorify you, only as long as there are 10 righteous in a city, in an American city, like you told Abram all those millennia ago, if there are 10 righteous, you won't destroy us. And only if we obey your law. It's so simple. Your law is so simple. Little kids can understand it. They can get it. And only if we make our servants obey our simple law. And that's the mission you put us on. By your grace, I don't know how you did it, but you put us on that mission. We're on it. What a mission. What a mission, Lord. What a privilege. What a joy it is to know this stuff, to see we're living in the best time ever in our history. Thanks to you, our Maker. How amazing is that? Give us more faith, Lord. We tend to lose it if we're on our own. We just tend to lose our faith. Give us perseverance, Father. We've forgotten what that is. I think a lot of us have forgotten what it is to just stick with something. Teach us to love those that They don't love us back. They throw ugly words at us. They don't understand what we're trying to say, or they disbelieve it, or whatever. We're ministering to them. We're ministering to them. Take whatever they fling at us. That's part of the job. Lord, give us a long fuse to take that. To do this work in this place, in this time. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. Thank you, David. The gift of perspective. Well, good Sunday evening and welcome, everyone. This is John Lazorek in West Virginia. I'm a co-founder of the American Again Trust and a founding board member of Tactical Civics Institute. It appears that we will not quite complete until next Sunday night this six-part podcast series that we're calling Who Killed America's Militia? There's a lot of history here, more and more the more we dig through it and try to explain it. History, most of you will not have heard, history that we need to know in order to understand how we got into the coils of the python. Tonight, we're going to bring you part five of the six. We will cover the first two military academies. We will cover the War of 1812 and wars of our national expansion, including a quick history of the famous U.S. cavalry, the war with Mexico for what is now our American West, and Washington, D.C.'s first major war of empire, bringing us up to the beginning of the last century. It sounds funny to say that, but we're all getting older. In our final podcast of the series next week, we will open with the infamous Dick Act, showing how Congress's clever and incremental use of new labels and federal bureaus first chipped away at the state militias and finally erased them entirely. Since constitutional militias have a law enforcement and border control aspect as well as the task of military defense, we have already described in past episodes the birth of the illegal FBI, but next week we will tie it all together in the administration of possibly our second most destructive president after Dishonest Abe, and that was Tom, remembered as Woodrow Wilson. David, you are point man in this safari. Please start this one off for us.
Okay. John, last week, I think it was last week, maybe week, no, week before last, I think, my friend, Joe Mensch, a chapter founder from Texas, he asked about the U.S. Cavalry. And I wanted, before we finish up tonight's episode of this series called Who Killed America's Militia, let me introduce very briefly the history of the U.S. Cavalry. I'm going to be a little cynical, but I will be accurate. Okay, from 1775 to 1783, during our war for independence, America's colonial horse-mounted fighters were learning lessons from the British, what they called the mounted dragoons. In 1802, Congress established a U.S. military academy at a fort called West Point on the Hudson River, 50 miles upstream from New York City, to train militiamen and other volunteers for assembly into armies, to assemble together into armies for up to 24 months for specific wars. So we never gave Congress any power to create and run a college, but apparently nobody cared enough to stop it. So here it was, West Point gets started. In 1808, and again in 1812, in the War of 1812, U.S. mounted troops were assembled again in emergencies, just ad hoc, and then they were disbanded when the emergency passed or when that war passed. So that's the way we stipulate in the Constitution, no full-time troops. But Congress violated the law, and they did it anyway, full-time troops. They created the first U.S. Dragoons in 1833. And then they created the second U.S. Dragoons in 36, and then the U.S. Mounted Riflemen in 1846. So notice, Congress does this a lot, by the way. You're going to notice this all the time. Congress begins by just making a new name for something. In this case, they took state militias, assembled them together, and gave them a name. First U.S. Dragoons. Then 2nd U.S. Dragoons, They weren't. They were state militiamen. Anyway, everybody knew back then it was illegal to have a standing army, and that's still stipulated in our highest law. Still, it's the law today. Can't have a U.S. Army. So America's industrialists and politicians, they wanted it all from sea to shining sea. They, you know, give me more, give me more. And after the fact, I think all of us are glad they did this. They plundered America because we became the huge, the massive, you know, republic that we have become, very abundant. I just spoke to the Lord about it right now. It's an amazing place. But it, still, I mean, it was, you know, plundering the countryside rather than just defending their own community. So in this case, it started against the Indian nations. The U.S. Army was projecting power, as they say. That's a term they use a lot in the war industry, projecting power. So in the Mexican War of 1846-48, some of the Indian wars were still going on, Washington, D.C. was heavily relying on these mounted militiamen, because obviously if you're moving all the way across Mexico trying to go capture Mexico City, you're not going to do it on foot. At least you're not going to move very fast on foot. So horse-mounted militiamen became the deal. By 1855, Congress added the 1st and 2nd Cavalry regiments to the U.S. Army, which, again, still illegal, but for now they were using it during a war and left it alone. The Constitution, the way it's written, says Congress can only assemble armies for 2 years. That was all out the window now. So in a few years later, you're going to see Lincoln just takes free reign. We already talked about that in past Sundays. Okay, so August 1861, Congress turned the U.S. Army's two regiments of dragoons and one regiment of mounted riflemen and two regiments of militia-based cavalry. They kind of bunched them all together and created the official U.S. Cavalry. So they were instrumental in subduing the southern half of our republic. You know, the tariff and trade war that we call the Civil War, we miscall the Civil War, and it's mistaught and it's misremembered as the Civil War. And many people disingenuously still claim that it was really all about ending slavery. It was not. Anyway, the U.S. Army's permanent mounted force was no longer called Dragoons now. Now it had a real name. It was the U.S. Cavalry, made up out of whole cloth, folks. Nowhere does the Constitution allow this. Did it anyway. And it played the key role in extending these empires of these multi-millionaires, the railroad and timber magnates, the land speculators, the earliest oil wildcatters, across the Wild West. These are the men who owned Congress back then, just like the billionaires own Congress today. Okay, they wanted stuff, so they used Congress to get it. So you start making up names. That's where you start. Make up new names. So the U.S. Cavalry covered vast ranges of territory between, you know, isolated federal forts that were hundreds of miles apart. U.S. Army foot soldiers could have never done that. You needed horse. So this is how America expanded. We have to admit it. Plunder, plain plunder. That's how we expanded. That's our story. We can't really run away from that part of our history. Washington, D.C. then subdued the Confederate states by 1865, well, during those 4 years. And then during the 12 years after that, called Reconstruction, supposedly, the U.S. Cavalry played a really big part. And 20 years later, in the so-called Spanish-American War, supposedly liberating but actually capturing the people of Cuba and Guam and the Philippines in 1898. So the cavalry also played a major role all the way up to the First World War, Europe's First War, when we got into it on the Western Front in 1917 and 18. There was the U.S. Cavalry, not very big by that time, but they were there, on their horses, World War I. Prior to the Second World War, Europe's Second War, the U.S. Army kind of split up into, they had infantry, mechanized divisions, and mounted forces. So they had, you know, cavalry, mechanized, and guys walking on foot. The last horse-mounted U.S. cavalry charge took place on the Bataan Peninsula against Japan in the Philippines in 1942. The U.S. cavalry in 1942, imagine that. And then by 1950, the cavalry was absorbed in the U.S. Army's armored branch, which made no sense. Cavalry mean cavalier. It's supposed to have to do with caballos, with horses. But anyway, now it was tanks. Tanks were horses. And then came the Vietnam, you know, oil fields of Vietnam and the rubber bonanza of Vietnam. And, of course, industry wanted in there. So we went to Vietnam to get some of that action. And helicopter squadrons were renamed the Air Cavalry. So, Joe, that is the story, as I dug it out, of the U.S. Cavalry. The global banking and industrial cartel uses Congress, folks. They use government schools. They use media to fool us, to dupe us, to make us, to give us a story. Okay, a story that we can believe. That's the tragedy of our history. Are we going to finally start learning, and will we repent our willing cooperation with these huge crimes? No, God knows. But just telling you the story of the U.S. cavalry, it started with subduing Indians, then subduing the southern states, then invading any foreign country that had, you know, a lot of natural resources and a little military. And the U.S. cavalry was always there, always on the job.
On the job. Let me jump in here for a minute, David. While we're on the subject of Indians, I'll put in two side notes that actually tie back into the rule of law. As you may know, as all of you may know, the Alaska Permanent Fund, so-called, is a $65 billion socialist trust fund created from that state's oil revenues. Since 1976, it has paid every Alaska resident, roughly 15% of whom are of Native ancestry, what we used to call Indians, between $700 and $2,000 per year just to live there. If their governor, Dunleavy, has his way, that will go up to $4,000 per Alaskan this year and next. So if you have four kids, you'll get $24,000 this November and next. How do you think that will impact Alaskans' willingness to work for a living? Amazing. And as the second Indian factoid concerning D.C. and the rule of law, we've described in earlier podcasts how the FBI created itself out of whole cloth and has no constitutional authority to exist. Well, the FBI happens to be the only American law enforcement organization with claimed jurisdiction on Indian reservations. For decades, these Indian reservations, being sovereign on their own and exempt from laws against gambling, have run casinos, which have become a massive network of criminal activity involving bookies, and drug gangs, and prostitution, and deeply, sadly corrupt elected Indian officials and even federal district judges. Yet how many stories have you seen of the FBI busting a crime on the reservations, even though they claim jurisdiction there?
Not one. I haven't seen any.
Nor I. No, technically, except for the FBI, which created itself, as we said, and has no authority to exist, every Indian reservation is a separate sovereignty inside the sovereign state where it exists. The state grand jury and the militia of those states have no jurisdiction on Indian reservations. Separate sovereignty. Like California and several other states now, criminals can enjoy sanctuary inside the Indian reservations if they pay off the leaders enough, I suppose. This lawless trend, like so many, should open our eyes more than ever to the fact that it is time to restore our state grand jury and state militia, because the march of evil, you need to oppose it, and we have no effective fetters for it now.
Amen. That's what we had. That's what the Founding Fathers left us. Why do we even have Article 1, Section 8, Clauses 12 through 16? You read it. Why do we, as a people, what are we all defending? According to those clauses, what are we defending? We're defending our homes, yeah, but also our communities and our culture And every aspect, if you bundle them together, every aspect of what we call civilization. And as you see, all of you see this today, the enemies of civilization, the enemies of God and sanity and of humanity, just plain humanity, they're enrolling children from what, age 4, age 5 on? They took the government school system, they took the media, now most social media too. So how do we fight this? Is this really only about our guns?
No, hardly. Guns are the important part. They're the teeth and claws, but it's about so much more than that. Let me tie the microeconomics and ethics back in here. That's why I mentioned the people of Alaska being paid for nothing. What part, we ask, does a huge national military industry play in our security and rule of law? What role does it play? None, actually. Instead, it amounts to a massive jobs program and pork program for all the huge constellation of suppliers, and a reform school for unemployable American youth. If there are government schools taught useful, or if people took it upon themselves to teach useful social and industrial arts instead of communism, instead of false history and perversion, then they could be the reform school and the jobs program, rather than having to deploy young Americans to plunder foreign lands for industry.
Amen.
So it comes back to the principle we hear so much these days, follow the money. War it probably has always been the most massive human industry. It's miserable, it's tragic, but it's true. And it's also the world's largest reform school and largest jobs program. Millions of parents, they love the illegal standing army because it solves huge problems in countless homes that, of course, these parents really created themselves. Instead of prison, Johnny or Jamal or Juanito wear a fancy-looking uniform, and they hear, thank you for your service, wherever they go. What's not to like about that? And then, of course, the oil industry and the other plunder operations get free security services, and military families get relief, and they get honor. Even if the tasks that their children are doing don't deserve the honor, far from it. This is the ingenious psychological and sociological trap that the military-industrial complex has built. Forget the Constitution. Illegal though this all may be, we now are trying to expose this monster at our peril.
Yep, at our peril. We don't. This is not a popularity contest, that's for sure. And that's why even the most highly decorated, highest ranking general, Smedley Butler, U.S. Marine Corps General Smedley Butler in the mid-1930s, and five-star U.S. Army General Dwight Eisenhower in 1961, they exposed it. These military men exposed it. They warned us against it. They told us this was coming. They talked about this mafia, this monster. And they had essentially no chance of raising enough awareness to break its grip at that time, but working against not only the war and the banking and the oil industries, but also working against the media and the colleges and the and the high schools and the middle schools and the you know, all the way down to kindergarten. Look, we've undergone a military takeover, a coup against our Constitution, that these two generals, these highly decorated generals, told us was coming. And it was all for industry, and it was all for banking. So amazing.
Yeah, it's catastrophic. We think about a coup as something that happens in South America or Indonesia.
Yeah.
But in effect, it has happened here. So, back to our story of who killed America's militias, which ultimately are supposed to be the defense against all this. So, the U.S. Army Academy at West Point, we said, had its earliest roots in 1776, when the Continental Congress created a so-called Corps of Invalids to help out disabled men from the militias, including, quote, to impart military knowledge to young gentlemen, unquote. In 1781, this so-called Invalid Corps was moved to the military garrison located at West Point. but it was disbanded in 1783, as it should have been, after the war ended, as the Constitution stipulates. With about 50 men, West Point was the largest military post at that time. During his presidency, George Washington, first president under our Constitution, lobbied for a so-called National Military Academy to teach the art and science of war. He was a man of war, and we benefited from that. We might not have the country we have today, but for that sad science. His Secretary of State, Thomas Jefferson, argued correctly that there was no provision in the Constitution allowing for creating colleges or military schools. Many in Congress felt that establishing a military academy would slide us right back into the monarchical and aristocratic European culture we had just fought free of. But nonetheless, in 1794, the warmongers won, and Congress authorized the establishment of what they called a Corps of Artillerists and Engineers at the West Point garrison location. Not much happened with this idea for a while, although our militia losses on the frontier did motivate Congress to authorize President John Adams to improve the instruction at West Point. Still, nothing really happened, and when Adams left office in 1801, the Corps at West Point consisted of only a dozen cadets and one instructor. Hypocritically, against his earlier warning, hard to tell what changed his mind, against his earlier warning to President Washington, after Jefferson became president in March of 1802, he called for and signed legislation establishing a Corps of Engineers at West Point and a military academy. Though it was only an old military fort with a mere handful of students, West Point became a seed from which politicians laterly germinated the entire illegal permanent U.S. Army.
Exactly. That's how they did it. It was just a seed. West Point became, and then came the less than 10 years later, 9.5 years later, came the War of 1812. That was America's first declared war. The war that came to be called Mr. Madison's War. They hung it like an albatross around his neck. There had been years of angry diplomatic salvos back and forth across the Atlantic. Neither side was ready for war when it came. Britain, for its part, was heavily tied up, engaged in the Napoleonic Wars, and most of the British Army was deployed at that time in what was called the Peninsular War. It was Spain and Portugal. Their navy, the British Navy, was blockading pretty much the whole coast of Europe. They didn't have enough ships to go around, so there were about 6,000 British troops in Canada in July of that year, of 1812. Plus, there were some Canadian militia fighting under the crown, and the U.S. wasn't prepared either. Madison assumed that the militias of the various states were going to move up, easily occupy Canada, and then, you know, negotiations would follow quickly and no sweat. But in 1812, the called up army of all the different militiamen consisted of a total of under 12,000 men. So Congress authorized then assembling a bigger army, up to 35,000 men. But most of the militias objected. They did not want to attack and did not want to occupy a foreign country. It's not what militias did. So their so-called, what George Washington would have called their discipline, was poor. Their morale was terrible. They didn't want to plunder.
Exactly. And what better example of the advantage of defense by a militia instead of a professional army?
Right.
The average good American militiaman was magnificently and appropriately not keen on attacking people outside his own sovereign state, especially when his state was not even being threatened.
Right.
The warmongers, what could be more natural? The warmongers were unpopular, especially in New England, where anti-war fever ran high. Two Massachusetts congressmen who were supporting war were publicly insulted and hissed in Boston. Charles Turner, a congressman from Plymouth and chief justice of the county court of sessions, was seized by a crowd on the evening of August 3rd, 1812, and kicked through the town for being a warmonger. what he deserved. And additionally, the states had great difficulty raising money for the unpopular war. Congress had disbanded the First Bank of the U.S., and private bankers in the Northeast were opposed to the war because they traded heavily with England. So D.C. had finally to obtain financing from, of all places, the London-based Barings Bank to cover its overseas bond obligations. Yeah, banking knows no loyalty, does it?
Oh, man.
The New England, they profit, whoever's shooting
wow.
them, they love it all. The New England state's refusal to provide militia units or financial support was a serious blow to the war. There were even loud threats of secession by New England states to the point of consuming the Hartford Convention. Britain, of course, exploited the sectional divisions. It blockaded only southern ports for much of the war and encouraged smuggling. The war went on nonetheless, and I guess we won it.
We did. We kept ourselves together, didn't we? Besides, at that time, the Indian Wars raging across America throughout that period, and for the next decades, for the next generation and a half, or two generations. But the next major project for the land speculators, rail men, oil men, timber men, military-industrial complex, their next project was the Mexican War, Mexican-American War, so-called. Actually, it started down here with Texas War for Independence, 1836. The fall of the Alamo, and then we turned around and whipped the Mexican army at San Jacinto, Battle of San Jacinto, near modern-day Houston. And so Washington, D.C. recognized us, the Republic of Texas, in 1837, and then accepted us as a state in 1845. And so obviously now Mexico was going to declare war. The U.S. was just taking entirely too much. So that same year, John Slidell was sent down as an ambassador to negotiate in Mexico City to purchase California and New Mexico, in addition to already annexing Texas. So Mexico didn't like it, didn't like any of it. They threw Slidell out on his ear. 1846, the next year, President Polk, and that's a long story I won't get into, but ordered General Zachary Taylor to advance down to the Rio Grande River here south of me. That provoked skirmishes back and forth. That pushed Mexico to declare war on the U.S. So, and then Polk gave his message to Congress for war, and Congress agreed and declared war on Mexico. So during that same time, over in California, Sonoma, Americans living in Sonoma declared themselves to be the new Bear Flag Republic.
Yes, that's a good story, David. Let's tell that one because it does tie
it
in
is.
with what is still happening today in California.
Yep.
Remember, the year 1846, a small militia expedition got instructions on July 3rd to go via the Santa Fe Trail from Fort Leavenworth back in Kansas to take over New Mexico. They reached Santa Fe, but then they went on until they got to Los Angeles, arriving in January of 1847. Keep that in mind. They were in Los Angeles by January of 47. Meanwhile, Washington, D.C.'s troops were moving through Mexico. They captured Buena Vista and Chihuahua in February, Veracruz in March, and they were headed for Mexico City in April. They occupied every major Mexican city on the way, and Mexico City fell in mid-September. President Santa Anna fled, which made it very difficult to find competent Mexican authorities with whom to negotiate a peace treaty. But the American envoy there remained even after he had been recalled, and he negotiated a treaty with Mexico in February of 1848, which the U.S. Senate ratified in March. The treaty established the Rio Grande as the boundary for Texas and gave the U.S. ownership of California and a large area comprising roughly half of New Mexico, most of Arizona, Nevada, Utah, and Colorado.
Yep, including good old California. Still, the Mexicans are moving in fast. Anyway, in 1846, Americans had already been a pretty big, a pretty active presence in that part of Mexico for generations, actually, beginning with they were trading in sea otter furs. And so when that started declining, they started developing bigger and bigger ranching operations, cattle ranching in the Sacramento River Valley to meet Eastern Americans' demand for beef and tallow and hides. And so Americans living in Monterrey or Los Angeles, they had intermarried. They had become friends and basically family with the old Mexican, you know, Californians and Spanish families. Some were Mexican. Some went all, they were Spanish. They were pure blood Spanish families that had settled there. So, but Americans in the Sacramento Valley stayed kind of separate on their own. They were, you know, the gringos. And they feared falling completely under Mexico's rule, number one, given the way Mexico had treated fur traders and more recently the way they had treated John Fremont, which we'll get into in a minute. So anyway, they were concerned. They were chicken. And then they got a false news report that 250 Mexican Californians were marching on Sacramento. So it wasn't true, but a crowd of Americans went to Marysville Buttes, where they met up with John Fremont, who had encamped there on his way back from Oregon Territory. And so that group of Americans seized a big remuda of horses belonging to the U.S. Army that were being driven down to San Jose. Anyway, we'll talk more about Fremont in a minute. But on June 14th, the Americans seized the administrative capital at Sonoma. And this was before the word had even gotten out that we were at war with Mexico.
Right, the right hand and the left hand didn't know what was going on. So this was when the short-lived so-called Bear Flag Republic was born. They had a hastily stitched flag with a star and the likeness of a grizzly bear that some thought looked more like a pig, but it was raised on the public square in Sonoma. The Republic of California, better known as the Bear Flag Republic, was born, and a proclamation set forth the justification and purpose of the revolution. But before its government could really get established, the Bear Flag Republic was eclipsed when the U.S. Navy arrived the following month. So the U.S. Navy Pacific Fleet arrived. John Drake's float, a veteran of the War of 1812, was in command. Float had the fleet sail for California. As soon as they got word of the declaration of war against Mexico, he feared that the British would seize the sparsely populated province. So on July 7th, when Sloat raised the Stars and Stripes at Monterey, that was the end of the short history of the Bear Flag Republic. Today, the California state flag retains those symbols, of course. Remember, the borders of the modern state of California did not exist back then. All of these places that we're discussing were still just undifferentiated parts of Mexico.
That's right.
So, just as in New Mexico earlier, the Mexican population in California didn't like this. They rose in opposition to the new regime. Spanish-speaking residents who were referred to as californios had never been very loyal to Mexico City, but they were even less keen about a new American-backed government. So by October, they had pushed U.S. forces out of Los Angeles while fighting continued on other fronts. So in December, that small U.S. Army force that we mentioned earlier arrived in Southern California. They were exhausted from traveling through New Mexico all the way from Kansas, and they suffered heavy losses at the hand of the californios. But in January of 1847, a coordinated attack was staged against Los Angeles, with Kearney arriving by land and Stockton by sea, and it fell to U.S. Army and Navy forces on January 10th.
January 10th, 1847. And then Fremont got there. He did mop-up operations against the californios. Mm-hmm. And on the 13th of January, he represented Washington, D.C. in signing the Treaty of Cahuenga, which ended the war, at least in the California theater of battle. Let me mention, John C. Fremont, this guy, he was native of California, born in California. He's a key figure in all these events, but also in later events. He was He was a U.S. Army Corps of Topographical Engineers guy. He was charting new trails across the West for the government. And so when he and his mapping team were ordered out of California by the Mexican authorities back in 1845, he went up to Oregon Territory, set up camp there, and then in June of 46, he came back, reached Sonoma, where he played kind of an unofficial but still an important part in the revolt you just talked about, John, the Bear Flag Revolt. So he played a part in that, and he later served as the military commander of all the pro-American community. Remember, this is all still Mexico, but the pro-American community that were going on to become the first GOP presidential candidate a decade later was John C. Fremont, the first GOP presidential candidate. So representing big business, of course, but he lost. He lost in the 1856 election to Democrat James Buchanan, of course.
Right. Well, this now brings us up to the next war-making educational institution, the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland. Unlike West Point, the Annapolis campus was not established by Congress, since we the people do authorize a permanent Navy in the Constitution. So the Navy itself, under its Bureau of Ordnance in 1850, started that school, the Naval Academy, with a few dozen students. Annapolis has always been a politically elite institution. Prospective candidates must be nominated by members of Congress or other highfalutin public employees, including the president, the vice president, or the secretary of the Navy. Unless, of course, you're the child of a Medal of Honor recipient, then you can be admitted to Annapolis without being nominated. But in the same year, of course, 1850, we have the Compromise of 1850, the Bleeding Kansas debacle, and then following right away, we have Lincoln's War and 12 years of U.S. military occupation of American communities, which went on until 1877. And during this period, the slow squeezing out of militias by the private industry contractors that we've spoken about before, like the Pinkerton Agency, and then the FBI, and even the invasion and takeover of the Kingdom of Hawaii by the U.S. Marines in 1894. We've talked about all of these things in earlier podcasts.
Yeah, we have. It was just incremental, just boom, 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 boom. The militia had nowhere to go. You know, before 1899, Mark Twain was really an ardent imperialist. He was big time. In the late 1860s, in the early 1870s, Mark Twain had been speaking out in favor of American businesses in the Hawaiian Islands and growing our empire in that direction. He even said the trumped-up war with Spain, the fake war with Spain in 1898, was the worthiest war ever fought, he said, at the time. But then, very quickly, soon as it was over, he recanted. In the New York Herald in 1900, Mark Twain describes his transformation and his political awakening in the context of that war, the Philippine-American War. He wrote, quote, "I wanted the American Eagle to go screaming into the Pacific. Why not spread its wings over the Philippines? I asked myself. Here are a people who have suffered for three centuries. We can make them as free as ourselves. Give them a government, a country of their own, put a miniature of the American Constitution afloat in the Pacific, start a brand new republic to take its place among the free nations of the world. It seemed to me a great task to which we had addressed ourselves. But I've thought some more since then, and I've read carefully the Treaty of Paris, which ended the so-called Spanish-American War, and I've seen that we don't intend to free, but to subjugate the people of the Philippines. We've gone there to conquer, not to redeem. It should be our pleasure and duty to make those people free and let them deal with their own domestic questions in their own way. And so I'm an anti-imperialist. I'm opposed to having the eagle put its talons on any other land." Unquote.
My already great respect for Mark Twain rises further. That and doesn't it sound as though that might have been written about some much more recent American military adventures?
Oh, man.
About
a couple
Iraq,
of World
perhaps?
Wars. Oh, Iraq, you bet.
Yeah. So, well, that beautiful and beautifully stated change of heart was probably the result of some of the dreadful stories coming from the D.C. invasion of the Philippines. American soldiers and other witnesses sent letters home describing atrocities committed by American forces. For example, in November of 1901, the Manila correspondent for the Philadelphia Ledger newspaper wrote, "The present war is no bloodless engagement. Our men have been relentless, have exterminated men, women, children, prisoners, and captives, active insurgents, and suspected people from lads of 10 up. The idea prevailing that the Filipinos as such, that the Filipino as such was little better than a dog." A quote from Philadelphia Ledger. Reports were received from soldiers returning from the Philippines that upon entering a village, American soldiers would ransack every house and church and rob the inhabitants of everything of value, while those who approached the battle line waving a flag of truce were fired on. When some of these letters were published in newspapers, they became national news. Here's a soldier from New York. Quote, "The town of Titatia was surrendered to us a few days ago, and two companies occupy the same. Last night, one of our boys was found shot, his stomach cut open. Immediately, orders were received from General Wheaton to burn the town and kill every native in sight, which was done to a finish. About 1,000 men, women, and children were reported killed. I am probably growing hard-hearted, for I am in my glory when I can sight my gun on some dark skin and pull the trigger." A corporal, Sam Gillis, wrote, quote, "We make everyone get into his house by 7 p.m., and we only tell a man once. If he refuses, we shoot him. We killed over 300 natives the first night. They tried to set the town on fire. If they fire a shot from the house, we burn the house down and every house near it and shoot the natives. So they're pretty quiet in town now." U.S. Army General Jacob H. Smith gave this order, quote, "I want no prisoners. I wish you to kill and burn. The more you kill and burn, the better it will please me. I want all persons killed who are capable of bearing arms." And that is the song of a professional army.
Wow. Wow, John. Yeah, it is. It is. That's what professionals do when they're hired to kill people and break things. Looks like we're going to have to end on that grisly note. It's 8:51. Next week, we'll open up with the 1903 Act of Congress that transmogrified the militias into a National Guard and into a State Guard system, entirely violating the Constitution. Anyway, in past episodes in this series, we explained how Woodrow Wilson's administration used the mysterious Black Tom explosion and the ridiculous sinking of the HMS Lusitania, just as McKinley and Teddy Roosevelt before had used a mysterious explosion and sinking to stoke American empire around the world in this quote-unquote Spanish-American War. So the banking and oil and war troika of industries, they always need new wars, folks. They always need new wars. And to really fight those wars, they need warriors. They need warriors. That's a guy that gets a paycheck and gets benefits from Caesar. That's different from militia, isn't it? The Founding Fathers knew this was going to happen. They did everything possible to keep it from happening. That's why the Constitution is written the way it is, to protect the original national defense and the law enforcement and the border control power of the people, of us, when we serve in constitutional militia. So
we the people.
Yeah, it has to be us, and you can't get paid. Look, I hope tonight that we've exposed, like we did, for the past four incremental times that we still have one more next Sunday. We're exposing the incremental lawlessness of our Congress. These are people who work for us under that law. They break it. They break it and violate it all the time. How do they do it? I showed you. John showed you. They use new labels. They make up new bureaus. They slowly erase our constitutional militias that way, folks. They make a new bureau. They make a new name. Always, they create an unexplained, mysterious explosion, sinking, whatever, a spark for a war, and boom, there you go. War fever heats up really fast. It breeds generations, eventually, of dependent military families, like John was describing just a few minutes ago. What a lot of people call our warriors in harm's way. And it makes it, do you see how it's impossible, politically anyway, socially, it's impossible to stand against this, folks. You get called every name under the book if you stand against it. If you talk in any way other than awe and honor of these guys, you get raked over the coals. Meanwhile, you've got these justly, totally frustrated, what are they, vigilante groups, you know, we call them militant groups, in every state right now you've got them. They're trying to become the militia again. They don't know where to start. They don't know the story we're telling you, we've been telling you for the past 6 weeks. They don't know this story. They don't know what it was, how it became what it is today, why it's such a mess today, why they can't make any, they just don't know.
That's our mission, to tell them how we got here and to tell them how to start, because God, do we ever need them back? So, finagling us, to get a little bit back onto the track, finagling us into Europe's First World War brought a major difference. With no authority from the Constitution, Woodrow Wilson ordered American militiamen overseas. That was, you can't describe that as anything but the act of a tyrant, but we will spin that one out next week. Thank you all for listening. Johnny B., let's hear from the audiences out there. We'd like to know if they're following this story of the crime, the war crime cartel in D.C., serving industry. Open it up, Johnny B.
Well, John, I think tonight we covered some of the rougher stuff. It's hard. This is very hard to hear.
It is. All these guys that get enmeshed in this dismal process shouldn't have to be there. You know, yes, we're all responsible for everything we do, but there are bad people pulling the strings from a long way off that drag people into things.
And these guys, I mean, a lot of these guys and gals, they're the best. I mean, they're some of the best Americans I know. It's not the people who enlist. It's the corporations that run this whole show, and it's really sad. But when you see behind, when you see how it was taken, how the militia was very slow. First, you give it another name, then you split it up. Next week, by the way, we're going to really cover how the transition happened from militia to National Guard to State Guard. Then National Guard and State Guard have to sign contracts together. Oh, man, it's a mess. Anyway, it all started 1903 with the Dick Act, and it's very interesting. That's the closing chapter of how the vice got closed on we the people's own national defense institution, the militias. How did we lose it? So we really covered the final chapter next time. And John, this has been I hate to call it fun, but it has been a fun and enjoyable, I've learned a lot from studying it, digging it out, and working with you on this series. So I really appreciate all you've done, and it's been great.
Me too. It's a very sad story, but it feels good to know it, because that tells us where we need to stick the crowbar in to start putting things back the way they're supposed to be. And that's what this is all about. We're not in the despair business. We tell these
that's
horrific
right.
stories about what we have done, what has been done in our name, not to get us all wringing our hands. There are plenty of people out there doing no more than that, but we have the tools still there that we can pick up.
To fix it. Yep.
To fix
You've
got to
know how it broke before you can fix it.
That's
you got to know what broke and how it broke so you can fix it. So, yeah, that's the part we're doing now. Well, Okay, let's see here. 253 area code. Go ahead.
Oh, I got a question because you guys were talking about on the Federal Reserve part. Now, how would the constitutional militia be able to, would they have the power to arrest those in the Federal Reserve Bank?
No, that's not part of, I don't think we mentioned that tonight, but if we did, we we shouldn't have. But that is kind of a separate issue. The financial crimes that are being committed by Congress have to be, it has to be broken down to a state penal code crime. In other words, first you have to get the actor into their state. They can't be working in Washington, D.C. full-time. If they are, then they're outside the court jurisdiction, the legal jurisdiction of the criminal court of that state. And so you've got a federal crime being committed. Now, stick with me for a minute. If you have a federal crime, where is that federal crime recognized and handled? In the federal courts, right? Correct?
Right.
Okay, so if you go to Article 3 of the Constitution, now remember, this is us. We are creating three branches of government, and then we're defining them, and then we're limiting them. We're telling them what they can do, okay? So we the people are creating. All right, so we the people create a federal court, and that's the Supreme Court. And we tell it that it has some original jurisdiction, mostly appellate jurisdiction. That means it has to have already gone to a lower court, and then the U.S. Supreme Court will get it, and they'll handle an appeal. So they don't have to handle every case that comes around. Okay, so we, in Article 3, Section 1, we give the Congress the ability. First, we create the Supreme Court, and then we give the Congress the power, the authority, to create its own courts, federal courts. But that is only for federal crimes. That means, and we describe that in Article 3, Section 2 and 3, we describe what constitutes a federal crime or a federal case. Most
Correct.
Of everything that we see is not a federal case. Now, actually, the one you're talking about, which is counterfeiting, that's all it is, counterfeiting. They're counterfeiting United States money. What is lawful United States money? Well, go look in the Constitution. We tell you in Article 1, Sections 8 and 10, we tell you what it is. It's gold and it's silver. And we tell the states in Article 1, Section 10, we tell the states, we stipulate to the states, you can't do this. You can't make gold and silver, but you can only use gold and silver for all your business. Okay, you states, if you're part of this union, you can only use gold and silver coin. That's what we say, Article 1, Section 10. And we say, and you can't coin it. You can use it, but you can't coin it. You have to use gold and silver, but you can't coin it. So who can? Congress can. So we tell Congress in Section 8, in Article 1, Section 8, coin, gold, and silver money. We tell them what it has to be. They can't take paper and print it up. Now, if they do take paper, it has to be like a note, like a promise, like a warehouse receipt for gold and silver that you have on in store. So if the government has a certain amount of gold and silver, depending on how worked out the value of a U.S. dollar, they have to have that amount of gold and silver to print a warehouse receipt or a bill, you know, a U.S. Not a Federal Reserve note, but a U.S. silver certificate or gold certificate. And as long as they have the gold or the silver behind it to back it up 100%, they can go ahead and issue that paper. But only in that case. You can't just start printing paper and saying, oh, yeah, this is worth whatever we say it is. You want to bet? It's worth what the market says it is. And you go to Venezuela and see what what paper is, you know. Anywhere in the world that kind of thing has been tried, it's just counterfeiting. You're just faking money. You're saying, oh, yeah, this is real gold. And it's not. It's brass or whatever. And you say, no, it's real gold. Well, you're counterfeiting. And if you do enough of it, pretty soon people look at it, you know, or they assay it. They take it to an assayer, And they get it checked out, and they said, this isn't gold. And so pretty soon people start rejecting it. They say, I'm not taking that money. I don't want U.S. dollars, man. You're nuts. That's worthless paper. So that's what the world has been doing now for the past 8 or 10 years. The world, including China and Russia and Brazil and India and what they call the BRICS countries, they say, you know what? We don't want everything denominated in U.S. dollars anymore. We're going to do, when we're doing multilateral, you know, bilateral arrangements or deals, we're not going to have to go through the U.S. dollar anymore. We don't want the U.S. dollar. And they have every right to do that. And so they're doing that. Now, as it turns out, we talked about this many months ago, our government is in control of, I think it's 288,000 tons, metric tons, of pure gold that we captured from the Japanese and the Germans in World War II. Known as Black Eagle Gold, Yamashita's Gold, and the White Dove or White Something Gold. Anyway, there's several names for the different hoards that we ended up capturing. 288,000 metric tons. So, $17 trillion worth of gold, basically. So we have gold enough, if you want to say it's ours. If we did say it's ours tomorrow, if we just decided, if our government said, okay, that gold is ours, we're going to monetize it starting tomorrow, the whole world would, you know, the markets of the world would collapse. It's not really worth right now discussing what to do about A, because we haven't restored the militias yet. So even if the militias could take action to go and serve legal papers on people who are doing these financial crimes and bringing them in so that the grand juries of the states in which they live could take care of it, could bring them to trial. A, we don't have the militias yet, and B, we don't have the members of Congress broken up and brought back home yet. So those are some of the earliest steps that we're taking, but each of them takes one thing before anything else: lots of people. So we need a big network of people who know this stuff. And until we have that, we can talk until the cows come home. And none of this is anything but theory. So right now we're just doing, what we have to do first is this series that we're doing, we're teaching you where the militia died, how the militia died, who killed it, how they killed it, so that we know, A, we're not going to do that again, and B, here's how we get it back. So once we start restoring the militias, and John is working on that, John Lazoric, as I said, I think last Sunday, he's working with 12 or 14 or whatever men from all over the country. They're pulling together a team, or they are the team, and they're pulling together an executive order, a model executive order for governors in conservative states where we have governors who are very pro-gun. And we're going to start there. We're going to start getting some executive orders passed where these governors say, okay, I want to start obeying the law. And so our state is going to start appointing the officers for these militias. So do we have any takers out there? And so these militia groups need to get in line and say, all right, we're going to play by the rules. We're going to send you our list. Here's our list of guys we want to be officers. And we'll start a militia in our town or in our county. John, you want
to? Well, what we are trying to put back in place is the rule of law. All this stuff is law. It's so bizarre that it should seem so strange and unfamiliar, because it's been buried, it's been erased. But all we're trying to do is get the law working again. And the militia is an essential part of it. But as David said, since the corruption of the monetary system, since money is constitutionally under Congress's control, what we have to do is get Congress back under control of the law. And that is what our
that's what our
First Right and our Bring Congress Home campaign is about, to get Congress to where we can enforce the law on Congress.
Yes. So if you haven't watched the 21-minute video that's on our homepage, toward the bottom of the homepage, watch that. It walks you through the process, what we're looking to do, what we're praying that we can do and accomplish. Who knows how long it'll take, but we have to start by finishing the ratification of the first right in the original Bill of Rights so that we break Congress down into little districts of no more than 50,000 people. Once we do that, we'll have a big, big U.S. House, 6,400 members with very small districts. So they can't get real powerful, and the big corporations can't buy them easily, and then we bring them home. And the reason we can bring them home once there's 6,000 of them, and we can't bring them home today, is because right now you go to D.C. and you try to get any one of the 435 of those shysters to sign up to send themselves home, like hell. They're not about to send themselves home. They love the deal they have in D.C. They don't want to go home. They've been working their whole life. These are professional politicians that ever since they were in junior high, they've been playing, you know, I want to be a politician when I grow up. That's who these people are right now. They're politicians. Like John was talking about professional warriors. Well, we have a whole class of politics is an industry, folks. It's an industry. The two parties are... they're both one. They're two sides of the same thing. This is a, if you go to D.C., you really feel it. You feel it in every building. You feel it on every street. You see it in every rest. You just go sit in one of those outdoor, open-air restaurants and listen. Listen at the different tables. It's amazing the amount of graft and corruption and silliness and evil, just evil that goes on. And they laugh about it, and it just... power just running through that place. It's sick. It's sick. Just like ancient Rome. That's why 3 weeks ago when you and I covered that, John, when we opened Rome up for inspection and we showed you just how similar all of this is to when the Roman Empire was, you know, growing, and power just, it corrupts. It just corrupts. Yeah. So we bring them home. As far as the actual the money crimes are concerned, we, Tactical Civics, will not start that battle. We don't believe we have to start that battle. We think that particular battle is going to come on its own when the markets force the U.S. dollar into compliance. You can't keep just printing them up. You can't keep doing these counterfeiting runs that the Fed cartel is doing. So it's going to have to stop at some point, and when it does, we'll be ready. We'll be ready to jump right into that hole as soon as it opens. But we don't want to open that hole because that is not a healthy place to be. So does that answer your question?
Yes, it does.
In a very, very long-winded way, right? Well, thank you. What else do you have for us tonight?
Another quick question I wanted to ask. Once the constitutional militia is restored, now some people think the county sheriffs are going to have power over them. Is that, from my understanding, it will not be true because the county sheriff will have his duties, and the constitutional militia will have its duties?
Good question. John, you want to take that one?
Well, I agree with you, Alan. The sheriff is, the sheriff, the office of the sheriff actually comes down from an ancient English office called the Shire Reeve, who was basically a tax collector. But the militia is really an independent entity. And the only way a sheriff would have any authority over it would be, well, if an individual militia member broke the law, or in the hierarchical sense, if the sheriff was appointed by the state governor to be an officer over a militia unit. But they're really independent entities with very different histories. There's no reason they can't cooperate together.
Yeah, but, that's what Ed Vieira, who is probably America's foremost authority on the history and structure of the American militia.
Yeah, he's Dr.
Vieira says that, look, all kinds of armed magistrates have a place in this constellation of law enforcement, but they don't have the predominant place. The militia has the predominant place because it is the people's authority. And the people, of course, are the highest authority. Whenever you talk about the U.S. Constitution, our highest law, you have to look at, okay, who created it? The people. Okay, who's the highest dog on the people. So that's what Ed Vieira comes back to. He says, look, if you have a good sheriff, that sheriff's going to either be an officer or he's going to be, he's certainly going to work closely with the local militia or the county militia. If you have a bent sheriff, he's going to work against it. And you go get him. He's one of your targets. That's all there is to it. Any other armed thug in your community, you're going to go after them, right? So it happens to be a sheriff, hey, remember, when the people take to arms lawfully, they are the highest power. Remember, well, you may not remember because you probably didn't hear last week, but if you go back to last week's, the recording of last Sunday, we talked about the grand jury. And the grand jury has to lead in these matters. The grand jury doesn't follow, it leads. The grand jury starts the targeting, okay? If you want to go after a bad guy, the grand jury has to start the process, has to find, has to do a finding, has to go do discovery, and has to dig out evidence and has to bring in people and talk to them, including possibly the perp, the target. And when they do that, then they issue the arrest order. They issue the subpoena. They issue the warrant, either search warrant or arrest warrant. So you have to start off with the law, again, it's the people of the community serving in grand jury. So that, see how much power we have, folks. We have all the power. When you have bad people that everybody's complaining about, whether it's a bad, a crazy police department, or whether it's a crazy sheriff's department, or whether it's, bad people in government, whether it's your mayor or your governor, look at these governors that are creating law-free zones. They call them sanctuaries, but they're law-free zones. In some cases, the governor says, okay, the whole state of California is a law-free zone. If you're from anywhere outside of these United States, walk right in. We'll give you a voter ID card. We'll give you a driver's license and anything else you need. This is absurd. It's absurd. If you want to just have anarchy, just call it anarchy. For God's sake, be honest. Be honest with people. Say, this is, do the big anarchy, the big A in the circle, the big anarchy sign, and wear your black mask like an Antifa guy, and do it right if you're going to do that. Gee whiz. Anyway, okay, well, thank you very much for your, A, for standing up, B, for taking your county, and C, for speaking up the first night. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Doc in Florida, yes, sir. Alfred, you're up.
Hi, everybody. Hi, David.
Hey.
I have a little news from the South. And I want to tell you about we had a high school that got shot up about 2 years ago. It was down in Brevard County by the name of Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School.
Oh, that was a mess.
And got shot up very badly. Big news report. What didn't make the news is that the governor removed a fellow. I can't say his first name, but his last name was Israel. He was the sheriff of Brevard County, and the governor of the state of Florida removed him from office. And the reason I say that is because I've been browsing a channel that comes over public broadcasting. I was following a different issue and happened to run across the investigation of this event that took place in Brevard County. If you've watched any government proceedings on TV, I'm telling you, you're gonna be popping the no-dos.
Isn't it something? It's like watching a glacier, right? It's like watching a glacier.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the long and the short of it is that they're using this as a pretext to get rid of counties having elections for their sheriffs.
Mm-hmm.
They want them all to be arranged to come from Tallahassee.
Well, see, that's where we don't have a dog in that fight because, like John said, and I think I've mentioned at least once before, the old shire reeve, the ancient reeve of each shire in England, who was basically the king's thug, he went around collecting taxes and making sure rents were paid to the crown, or to the earls and, you know, the other big shots in the county. Those guys, they started out as thugs. They were thugs for the crown. Now, sheriffs, I'm not saying sheriffs are bad guys. I'm saying sheriffs are, how can I say this? They don't have, they run for office, so they become politicians, you know. And number two, they don't have enough oversight. Anybody who would have oversight over a sheriff, if he really tries to, you know, takes it seriously, you'll run into you'll have a battle of wills, and the sheriff will usually win. Why? Because he's got guns. He's got a bunch of deputies with guns, and he's been elected, and he'll say, "Well, I'm the elected official, you know, who carries a gun." And so it's really a funny thing how we've been kind of finagled into this thing where the average man in the average community has no power over the safety of his own home and can get thrown in jail for trying to take an action to stop a criminal or to stop someone from, you know, raping or killing or breaking into his house or whatever. In some states, the guy can end up in prison for it. So everything is cattywampus, Doc. Everything is cattywampus. And right now, you go and you watch government trying to take care of this. And what are you really watching there? It's a bunch of bureaucrats. It's a bunch of people who are on a payroll to do a certain thing and to look good on camera and all that. And they all cover one another. You know, they just cover one another. And it gets old. And so if something really bad happens, like one of these school shootings, if you had an active grand jury, a state grand jury in that county sitting, they'd be all over that thing. They would have, if the sheriff won't do it, they would have the militia in there walking those halls, taking depositions on lots of people, teachers, from the principal of the school down to the janitor of the school, anybody who saw anything, did anything. I mean, they would cover that thing like a bunch of ants. Why? Because it's the people of the community. They care. They really care. These are the people that pay the bills for all this stuff. These are the people who are the parents of those kids. You think they care? Who cares more than that? Nobody. So the grand jury is the natural defense. It's kind of like you're looking at a body that's being attacked by some kind of a bug, you know, and the antibodies start going to work right away. Well, the antibodies should. They're part of your body. They care. They, you know. So we're defending ourselves, and that's what, ever since, and again, like John Lazoric has said 10 times, ever since the ancient dooms of King Ethelred in the early 10th century, this has been the rule of law. This has been the common law of Western civilization. People know this. It's in your marrow. You feel it. You know that it's right for the men of the community to stand up and say, "Hell no, we've had enough. This stops here. We've had enough."
What our system and our constitution does is it makes that traditional common law into what you could call black letter law, into something that is explicitly belongs to everybody. What I like to say is that anybody can enforce the law if the system is working right. Anybody can enforce it, but nobody can break it, because the law belongs to everybody. So if the sheriff wants to step up and enforce the law, God bless him. If you as a member of the community want to grab that thief by the elbow and bring him in, God bless you. The law, not only by tradition in our country, but explicitly under the Constitution, the law belongs to each and all of us. So anybody can enforce it, but if we're all awake, nobody can break it. So we're here to wake us up.
And we have a process. We have a process for enforcement. And you can't just say, we're going to get a bunch of guys are just going to get together tonight and say, okay, we're going to take these people down. No, you don't do it that
That's
way.
That's right.
It's not the way it works.
That's
again,
right. Not only
going
did the
back to the ancient,
yep.
to the ancient dooms. You go back to Ethelred's dooms, and you see those guys over 1,000 years ago knew better than to say, "Oh yeah, let's just get a gang and go." No. You have to take deposition. You have to go talk to the people who saw, ask them what happened. I mean, this has been going on for 1,000 years. It's not rocket science.
Yep.
The
due,
grand
due
jury has to start the process.
Due process is to protect everybody.
Yep, because sometimes you're on the other side. Somebody,
right.
you know, says you did something. They can't prove it, but they say it. Uh-oh, don't you want a grand jury to at least look at it?
Absolutely.
So very, very good. Well, Doc, what else do you have?
That's all I've got. I'm satisfied with your response.
We're on it, man. We're on it. Our group, you included, you're one of the early guys. You're one of the early founders. We're finally standing up and at least figuring out the truck that hit us and where it ran over us. And so it's going to take time. All of these things, the re-education of America is not going to happen wholesale. It's going to happen person by person. So each of you, as you have time, as you can make time to sit down with one person that you know really well, a friend, not somebody that you think is going to blow you off, somebody that you know they'll believe what you're saying, sit them down and tell them what you're doing. Just tell them about what you're doing. Just go buy them a cup of coffee or something and tell them that you're founding, you know, that you're the seed founder of a county chapter of Tactical Civics, and they're going to think that sounds really funny, and they're going to ask you, and you can tell them. And just start explaining. We're taking our country back one county at a time, and we have to do this properly and lawfully and peacefully and et cetera. And so there's a bunch of guys that will help you. There's men and women coming out the wazoo. We now have over 130 of us around the country, from Alaska to Florida, from Maine to California. Join us. Ask them to join you. And it's preferable that they not live in your county. It's preferable that they live in other counties so that we can keep spreading this great news, this great work, this great mission that we have for all of America to bring sanity back to this place and to glorify God. Well, thank you all for being with us tonight. We really appreciate you being here. If you'd like, please be back with us again next Sunday night. Thank you very much for being with us. God bless you. Good night.
To learn more about this subject and more on our blog and Facebook group, and to take action in your county, go to tacticalcivics.com.